This series of messages that we're going to be concerned with are about one of the disciples, the Apostle Peter. And these talks will concern the strange tools that the carpenter of Nazareth used to shape a Simon into a Peter, shaped by adversity and hammered by time and circumstance. The rock was chiseled into shape on the workbench of this world. Now, I wonder what tools the carpenter of Nazareth wants to use to shape our lives, yours and mine. I believe there'll be the same familiar things, the ordinary things that littered Peter's life, that littered our lives. Now, he gives us, as he gave Peter, the privilege and capacity to cooperate in the process. We can lie still in his hand. We can hand him the tools. And that's what this series is all about. I'd like you to turn in your Bible with me to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 14, verse 22. And we'll read that together. We're going to think about one object, just one object. One of those familiar objects that's going to be used to shape Peter's life. Today, it's going to be a boat. What better object to start about when you think about the Apostle Peter? You found Matthew's Gospel, chapter 14. Let's read together. The 5,000 people have just been fed. Jesus has done this wonderful miracle with the bread and the loaves and the fish. And now he is going to send the people away in verse 22. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he'd dismissed them, he went up to a mountainside by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat was already in a considerable distance from the land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. And during the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, cried out for fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it's I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat. He walked on the water and he came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" When they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." Hundreds of years ago, or so it feels to me now, my husband and I, Stuart and I, were working among the young people in Europe. We'd go out on the streets, and just to help ourselves and give ourselves a little bit of a tool, we took with us a survey sheet. And we would stop young people right in the middle of the street, and we'd ask them a lot of questions. And one of the questions that would really get us going in conversation was this one: "What do you think of the church? What do you think of the church?" Now, that was a great question because they had all sorts of things they wanted to tell us at that point. Not that hardly any of those young people had ever been inside a church, but they wanted to tell us anyway. Most of the answers that we got were really under the title of speculation. Man trying to figure out what God was all about, and particularly what the church was all about. They didn't have some very helpful things to tell us, but we tried to keep our mouths shut and write them down anyway. And it gave us an opportunity later to talk to them about other things. What I got from all of that was a very interesting summary of what the world at large believes or thinks about the church. The view from the pew, or the view from the few in the pew, was very interesting indeed. Or to be more exact, the view of those who'd never been inside a pew was given to us. And in three words, I would sum up the answers to that quiz. They said The church, in effect, is inconsequential, inhospitable, and indifferent. They said the church is inconsequential. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change things. There is no difference to people when they go to church and when they don't go to church. Particularly, I remember a young man that I asked if he had ever checked it out, if he'd ever been to church. And he said, well, yes, I did once, just once. He said, I used to try and sleep on a Sunday morning, but the bells kept dinging and donging like they do in England on a Sunday morning, so I couldn't sleep. So I thought I'd get up and see what the ding-dongs were all about. He said, I stood outside the church and suddenly realized that I was dressed in my jeans and therefore didn't feel free to go inside in case people wondered who I was dressed like that. So I decided to stand there and watch everybody go in and then everybody come out. And I hardly dared ask him, but I did. And I said, what did you see? And he said, well, there was no difference. The people came out exactly the same as they gone in. No change in their face, no change in their manner. And I thought, well, if that's what church does or doesn't do, then I don't need it. I can look miserable like that without going to church. Inconsequential, it doesn't change anything, it doesn't matter. Secondly, inhospitable, you know, I've talked to many divorced people who say the church shoots the wounded. I have talked to many single parents who say, you know, I don't feel comfortable inside a church because it's inhospitable. The married women in the church keep me at arm's length because they're threatened. They don't want me near their husband, you see. And so I feel as a single parent who perhaps is single from no fault of my own that I can't belong to a church. It's inhospitable. And what about the teens? Well, we go back to the young man on the street. The teens say, well, if I go inside a church, I've got a feeling they'll tell me to turn my radio down or off. They won't like my music or they won't like my lifestyle. Church isn't for me. It's for the old and the dying and the sick and the women. And that's what a lot of teenagers feel about the church today. Church is inconsequential. The church is inhospitable. The church is indifferent. Now, that's what a lot of people think about the church. I was speaking to somebody on a plane not long ago. And I said, what do you think about the church? And they said, well, I'll tell you, it's indifferent. Don't you know that a third of the world will go to bed hungry every night? And I said, yes, I do know that. And I also know that Gandhi said or described this condition of the third of the world that was eternally hungry as the eternal compulsory fast. The eternal compulsory fast. That's what Gandhi said about this hungry world of ours. And so this man on the plane said to me, and there you are. Who's doing anything about it? The church certainly isn't. Well, of course, I do believe the church is doing much about that. Not enough, never enough. But many, many people looking at the church say, it's pie in the sky when you die. You're so heavenly minded, it's no earthly use. Is this the picture of the church? Or is this just man's speculation? There is another word I would like to talk about, and that's revelation. Speculation is man trying to figure out what God is like, what the church is about, etc. Revelation is God having figured it all out because he thought of it all in the first place. Revelation is God revealing that truth to us. God has figured us out. He tells us how he sees us. The Bible reveals God's mind about everything, about our sin, about our life in general, about our relationships, all of that and more. Now, the Bible makes statements about the church. It also gives us types and pictures. Maybe that's because God is a father and we are his children. He likes to take us up on his knees and open the picture book of the Bible. But it's full of types and pictures in the Old Testament and also in the New. And there's some wonderful pictures of the church in the Bible. To begin with, the Bible is described, for example, as a building. And who but Peter describes it this way in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 2 following. You can read those passages and see that Peter says, you know, the Bible, the church is built on the foundation stone. And Peter is speaking. He doesn't say, I'm the foundation stone. Peter himself is speaking about Jesus Christ being the cornerstone or the capstone, the foundation stone of the Christian faith and the Christian church. So Peter is the one who tells us that Jesus is the capstone, the cornerstone, and all of us people that belong to the church, the living church of Jesus Christ, are living stones built on the living stone, with a capital S, who is Jesus himself. And you can read about that in the book of Peter, 1 Peter 2, verse 2 following. So here's a picture of living stones. And you see, we get the picture immediately from the Bible, from this little insight, that the church is people, not buildings. The church is people, not buildings. It was great joy to me to tell those young people that. Church, as my husband would say, is something you are, not somewhere you go. It's something you are, not somewhere you go. In fact, ecclesia, the called out ones, the people idea of the church, is all over the scriptures. It's a community, not a club, if you like. Many, many times you've heard me say, what I used to be asked on the streets of Europe, what abomination do you belong to, says the young man to me. People think of church as denominations all fighting each other. That's another reason people don't come in the church. Perhaps they've been inside and had one of those fights on their hands and they've had enough of it. Now, the church meets in many different buildings, but it is one church, worldwide, mystical. And that's another picture that we get in the scriptures. The picture of the church as a body. Christ is the head, Colossians 1:24, Colossians 1:18 tells us. He's the head of the church. Ephesians 1, verse 22 says, God has put all things under his feet, and he has made him to be head over all, head of the church. We are the members. Again, may I quote my husband? I can't think of anybody better I could quote. Stuart says that the definition of a body is an earthly vehicle whereby a spiritual entity gets round in a physical environment. Therefore, a definition of the living body, the church, is that as well. It's this spiritual Christ getting around in the physical environment in his body, the church, this earthly vehicle for his divine action. Now, that's a beautiful picture of the body, and we the members, or the building and the living stones. Also, the bride. The Bible talks about the church as a bride. The marriage of the Lamb is come, and the bride has made herself ready. That's why it's very important that we don't criticize the church. When I hear somebody criticize the church, I seem to hear from heaven, God saying, or Jesus saying, that's my wife you're talking about. So we have to be very careful, because the church is described in the Bible as a bride. And that's a beautiful picture, and I'm very tempted to get off on that, but I've got a lot to tell you, so I'm not going to. Enough to say that the Holy Spirit woos us, presents us with the bridegroom, Christ. He approaches our mind. He says, I want to introduce you to your heavenly husband. And as we are overcome with what we see in Jesus Christ, then we respond. And we become part of the bride, universal, worldwide. The engagement begins. And of course, in Bible days, the engagement was as binding as the marriage. You had to have a divorce to get out of it. And so this is the period of the engagement. You and I, as part of the bride of the bridegroom, who is the Lamb, or Jesus, are waiting for the marriage. Now, the marriage will actually take place in heaven. The marriage of the Lamb is come, Revelation 19 says, and the bride has made herself ready. If you've ever had a bride in your house, you can see the picture. I've had one bride because I have one daughter. Oh, what joy. Getting Judy ready for her wedding. It took all day. Fortunately, she had the wedding at night. I don't know what it must be like to have somebody married in the morning. But you know, when I helped Judy to get ready for her wedding, I had a wonderful, wonderful illustration of what it's like and what it's going to be like now as we are supposed to be getting ourselves ready for the marriage in heaven as members of the bride, as part of the bride. Aren't these pictures beautiful? the building, the body, the bride. But today, I'm going to use the boat as a metaphor of the church, which is quite a legitimate metaphor to use. For the boat in this story, I believe, can be used as a picture of Jesus' chosen vessels to get his disciples to a world that was waiting the other side of the lake. What was waiting for him the other side of the lake? Sick people, hungry people, blind people, desperate people. Now, the problem is, I believe, that in our day and age, the boat of believers is going round in a sea of confusion in circles, in evangelical circles, if you like, getting nowhere. That's a picture of the church. The boat of believers in the sea of confusion. Now, the problem is, the troughs of water are splashing right into the boat. And I believe the church is in danger of capsizing today. And yet Jesus intends this boat, this church of his, to get us, the disciples, to the point of need so that we might minister to a sick and a dying world. The problem is the billows. There's the crime wave, if you like. The currents of violence, not just on the streets, but in the homes, there's a storm of sorrow going on. Every minute, a child is molested. And perhaps if I've been going 15 minutes at this point, while I've been speaking, 15 little children have been sexually molested. You know, hundreds of years ago, when I was a teacher in the Liverpool school system in England, we used to go on playground duty, but we didn't call it playground duty. We used to call it vice patrol. And I can laugh about it now, but I tell you something, it was. Those little imps, those backstreet urchins, talk about cruelty. Talk about the sort of things they would do to each other. Little tiny children. Children can be terribly cruel. And of course, in this day and age, we see this in ever-increasing measure. Then there's the hurricane of hate. The contrary winds against the church, against the little boat. Remember the little boat being tossed? It says that it was tossed, thoroughly upset, being buffeted by the storm and the winds. And there is a hurricane of hate against the Church of Jesus Christ today. There are clouds of cults, if you like, on the horizon. There is the reign of reason, humanism, that says the miraculous is ridiculous. There has been such a hurricane of hate against the church and the teaching of the church that we have generations around us, even in the Western Christianized world, that do not know the true gospel story. And of course, people are in the depths of despair. We in this area are dealing with children in our high schools that are committing suicide with regular monotony. Terrible, terrible thing. The problem is the water's in the boat. Some of us are trying to bail it out, but it's like using a thimble to get the whole ocean back where it should be. And you think about this, I do, every Sunday, because I share my hymn book with one of those statistics that have come to church. It isn't outside. The water is not outside the boat anymore. The water is splashing right inside the boat. I heard a very shocking thing the other day. One of my friends was telling me, as she's working in the school district, that she heard a little boy talking to another little boy. Both were children of divorced parents, and they were discussing their situation. And one little boy said to the other, "Oh, you're just like me. My dad trashed me too." And apparently, the word that's going around and the word the children are using is just that. "Have you been trashed?" they say. "I've been trashed." I was absolutely devastated when I heard that. And I wondered when the boat is going to take the disciples to the point of those children's needs and address them in our Sunday school lessons. How do you explain to a child the fatherhood of God when he thinks his father has trashed him? I tried to put myself in the little boy's shoes, And I wrote this from his perspective. My dad trashed me, you know. Just trashed me. Hurts. I feel dirty. Ashamed. Must have been my fault. You have to be dirty or something to be trashed, you know. But it helped when my Sunday school teacher told me that when Jesus visited our planet, we trashed him. Just trashed him. Threw him away. Like rubbish to be burned. An amazing thing. He knew it would happen before he came, but he came anyway because he loved us and wanted to save us from drowning in sin's garbage. And God picked Jesus out of the trash. And he gave him clean clothes. Took him home with him to heaven. Now when I feel like trash, I think of Jesus. And it helps me. Oh, it helps. Because I know he'll never trash me. We live in a terrible world, don't we? And if the boat of believers is going round on the sea of confusion getting nowhere, we will never get to the other side and bring them the glorious news of the gospel of Christ. So let's look at the believers. Where are these believers? Well, we know where they were in the story. They were all sitting in the boat. And I want to look at the craven crew for a moment. And I want to ask some questions because you might see yourself sitting in this boat. You might be able to identify with one of these men. Of course, the whole series is going to be specifically about Peter. But just in this introductory session, this teaching session for this series, I want to give you an overview of the other disciples in the boat. These men that were charged with taking that vessel to a land to minister to people. These people, who were they? Well, first of all, we have James and John. Quick-tempered, intolerant. Remember one day they said to Jesus, "These people won't listen in this village. Do you want us to call down fire from heaven and burn them all up?" You know, they were real nice, gentle, loving people. In fact, Jesus said, "Oh, I'm going to give you a nickname, Sons of Thunder." And he could have added lightning, seeing they liked the idea of bringing fire down from heaven on people that didn't agree with them. Maybe you're a James or John. Are you competitive? Do you have a competitive spirit? They did. They were forever trying to figure out who was the greatest. I don't mean they were trying to figure it out. They'd figured it out already. They believed they were. It was just that the other disciples didn't agree. And so they always had this problem with the other disciples. Now, competitive spirits are not going to help to take the boat to the land. But unfortunately, in the church today, we have many James and Johns, sons of thunder. And Jesus needs to still the storm in their life, you see, and get them in shape if we're ever going to get the job done. When you get leaders or people in authority or leaders in the making, jockeying for position, building their own personal empire, then you're not going to be able to pull on the team oar very effectively. Pride doesn't pull on a team oar very well. Pride wants to steer the boat. In fact, I can just imagine James and John saying, "Why is Peter up there doing all this? Who says he should have taken charge?" The competitive spirit. That's one reason the boat isn't getting to the land and is wallowing in the storm. What about Andrew? What was he doing, do you think? Well, the scriptures tell us that Andrew was a finder and bringer of men to Jesus, but hardly a solver of problems. I believe Andrew, because of what I know of him from the scripture, was probably experiencing a profound sense of inadequacy, as all the disciples were, but him above all, because Andrew was an inadequate sort of person, I believe. In John's Gospel 6 and verse 8, in the story of the feeding of the 5,000, we see Andrew standing there helplessly. I mean, there were 5,000 people to be fed. And what did he have? A few little fish and some loaves. And I'm sure we would have said the same thing, but he did verbalize it. What are these among so many? What are these among so many? Do you ever feel like that? Have you ever stood in a situation, felt totally inadequate? And that way, you see, the boat never gets to the land. And the people don't get the message because you're inadequate. A leave it to Peter person. Are you a leave it to Peter person? That's what Andrew was. Oh, leave it to Peter. I mean, he was Peter's brother. Can you imagine that? All his life he'd left it to Peter. Even though Andrew was the one that brought Peter to Jesus, funnily enough. From then on in, he seems quite content to leave it to Peter. Do you leave it to Peter? Maybe you should stop leaving it to Peter. I remember being involved with wild young people. One of them, whose name was Brian, came to Jesus Christ. His life was changed. And if you could have seen this young man, you would have been amazed, as I was, to see and to hear the ministry that God began to give him, because it was with old people. Now, he had been a basher up of old people. He had been one who loved to rough them up, to steal their purses. Christ changed him and gave him a heart from the very people that he had been harassing. So he began to do things for them, paint their houses, take them out in wheelchairs for a ride. He just began all this completely on his own. And he invited me to the old people's meeting in the local clubhouse, where there were about 100 old people that the county brought in trucks and buses and things, to get together and have some fun. It was not a Christian organization. It was a state organization. Brian had got involved with this. He said, I want you to come, Jill, because he said, I think I could get us to give something at Christmas or Easter and talk about God. But he said, so sad. And I said, Brian. Well, what I said in effect was, leave it to Brian. Leave it to Brian. I was doing a leave it to Peter. But anyway, he dragged me along. And I thought, well, you know, I'm into young people. He can be into old people, but I'll leave it to him. And anyway, I felt inadequate. How could I minister to the old people? Well, you know, the first thing they did was read the list of all the people that had died since the last meeting. I said, what are they doing? He said, they're reading the death list. I said, how often do they do that? He says, every week. So they're dying like flies around here. And then he nudged me and he says, they need the gospel more than the young people. He got a point. He got a point. And I stopped leaving it to Brian or leaving it to Peter. And you know, it's a question of where's the need and filling it, isn't it? Are you an Andrew? Are you a James, a John? What about Philip? What was he doing? He was trying to buy off the storm, I bet. Philip was the one that said, 8 months' wages couldn't buy enough bread for everyone to have a little. You can't buy off the storm. Some people in the church think you can. If we throw money at the storm, it'll go away. Well, money sure helps. I can say that. Money sure helps to buy Bibles and literature and make it possible to bring in prominent, gifted men and women to minister to our communities. Money does that. But when you don't have money, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter if the heart is there and the will is there. But Philip was materialistic. A Philip thinker is the one that says, what's it going to cost? I bet he was sitting there saying, what we need is a bigger boat. Peter, this boat isn't big enough. Just look at the mess we're in. If we ever get out of this, I'm going to build a bigger boat. I bet you that's what Philip was thinking. And it's tempting to think that way. But essentially, we think that way even if it isn't about money. What's it going to cost me, we ask. That will not get the boat to the land and address the problem. Do you ever say, what's it going to cost me? What's it going to cost me to commit myself to a local fellowship of believers? What's it going to cost me to start and reach out in my neighborhood? What's it going to cost me to witness to my friend? You a Philip? What about Nathanael? What do you think he was doing? Well, he was, if you remember, in John's Gospel, chapter 1, a true Israelite in whom there was no guile. Jesus saw him under the fig tree, what? Praying. Guess what he was doing? I think he was praying about the storm. And you say, well, that's all right, Jill. Yeah, I mean, we need to pray about the storm. Sure, we need to pray about the storm. And I wonder how he was praying about the storm. We're not really told, and I don't want to defame wonderful Nathanael's character. I don't know how he was praying about the storm. But knowing Nathanael a little bit, knowing he was an Israelite, a man of the law, of the letter to the law, I wonder if, as well as praying about the storm, he was also wondering if Peter was being scriptural. He was the legalist, I think. Legalism is the watchdog of faith, but legalism can bite the one who has the faith. And I believe that perhaps Nathanael was watching Peter getting out of the boat and walking on the water and saying to himself, as a true Israelite would, "It's never been done before. He'll sink." And thinking in his mind all through the Old Testament, where did a man walk on the water? He couldn't think of it. He was absolutely sure Peter was not being scriptural. And maybe he was even saying, "There you are," when he sank beneath the waves. You know, it reminds me so much of the church today, this whole story. 11 disciples sitting on the boat criticizing the one that gets over the edge. That's Nathanael. The one who does the innovative thing. The one that does the thing that's never been done before. Maybe that's what's stopping us being effective. You and Nathanael. What about Thomas? What do you think he was doing? We know what he would have been doing. First of all, he might have been doubting there was a storm at all, although I don't think he would have been doing that. The word doubt means waver. Two ways standing, the word means. Uncertain which way to go. He was a negative personality. Negative personalities have a hard job getting the boat to the point of need, pulling their weight. I'm a negative personality. I'm a pessimist. So I really appreciate what Thomas had to struggle through to faith and trust. It's very easy for me to be obedient. Anybody can be obedient. No problem. I mean, anybody can choose to be obedient. That we can do. My problem is with trusting. But I think negative personalities tend to have trouble with doubt. I think Thomas was planning his funeral. Or Peter's funeral. One or the other. But that's what I think he was doing. Doubters have to have an explanation for everything, don't they? To quote Stephen Alford, "If you can explain everything that's happening in your church is dead." Doubters have to have an explanation. Thomas wanted to see the holes in Jesus' hands. "If I see it, I'll believe it," right? And that will stop the wonderful faith being exercised that needs to be exercised to see the ridiculous turned into the miraculous and the power of God. What was Matthew doing, do you think? I think he was being seasick. He was the one who wasn't a sailor. He was sick of it. He was sick of Peter, I'm sure of that. Tired of the work. And I've talked to you many, many times about being tired of the work of God. And there's a difference from being tired in the work of God and tired of the work of God. I think he was just sick of it. Some of you are just sick of it. You tried to get the women's work going. You tried to do something with the Sunday school. You tried to tell the church that what you really needed to do was to get something for the youth before we lost our youth. And they didn't do it. And you're sick of it. Oh, you're out of your depth. Why don't you just get to land and get the thing over with? You would identify today with Matthew. What about Simon Zealots? He had a political solution in mind. He was trying to keep the bread dry. Remember they picked up 12 basketfuls of bread from the feeding of the 5,000 that were over? Where do you think they were? Do you think they left them? Well, why did they pick them up? They were in the boat. And I think Simon Zealots, who, that was his nickname, incidentally, because he had a political turn of mind, was trying to keep the bread dry to show the people on the other side of the lake that Jesus could actually, physically, materially, take care of people. He had the social program in mind. He was trying to discuss it with Judas, who also had a political turn of mind. But Judas was lost. There's one of those in every boat. So he couldn't help at all. James the Less and Thaddeus, who were they? What were they doing? Who are they? They're the faceless disciples, aren't they, a little bit? They're the names you can never remember in a Bible quiz. Who are the 12 disciples? Well, there's Peter and there's James and there's John and there's... What's that guy? James the Less and Thaddeus. Faceless disciples. I bet they were wondering why Jesus had chosen them. No gifts. Giftless, they felt. They had nothing to contribute. If only somebody else was in the boat. And that left Peter. What was he doing about it all? Well, we know what he did about it. He got out of the boat. He bailed out. And I could apply this in many ways. Let me apply it this way. He decided, let's say, that he and Jesus would go it alone. He was sick of the lot of them sitting in the boat. He and Jesus would do it. And I get a lot of that attitude from people in churches. It's a sort of pride thing, in a way. And yet Jesus appreciated the spirit of Peter. I can just hear that great laugh of God going out over the waters. Come, Peter! That's my Peter. At least you'll do something. Peter did it. He got out of the boat. And then he saw the wind, and he took his eyes off Christ, and he began to sink. Jesus caught him, rescued him, and pulled him up wet and dripping, deposited him in the boat safely. And he said, oh, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? Why did you waver? Why did you become a Thomas on me, Peter? I wonder what he said to the 11 disciples that were sitting in the boat criticizing Peter. At least Peter got out of the boat and tried to do something about it. And you know, I have an idea that what Jesus is trying to say to the church in this day and age is, why don't you get your act together? And realize the church is my vehicle to get you to the point of need. Get the show on the road. So, Jesus and Peter got into the boat. What a wonderful end to this story. Absolutely marvelous. Three things we see happen. They began to reckon with the Christ they had received into the boat. Don't fear, I'm here, said Jesus. Be of good cheer, as the King James puts it. Don't fear, I'm here. That's a paraphrase. And you know, every time we get into that helpless situation of not knowing what to do in our personal lives, the corporate life of the body of believers, the church fellowship, what we've got to do is to get back to this story or the principles of this story and say, I've got to start and reckon with this living, marvelously powerful God, whom I profess to believe. They reckoned on his person. I am here. I am able. Moses had to come to that terms when God said, I am all that you will need as the occasion requires. Moses. What was his occasion? Leading 1.5 million people into a desert and keeping them alive for 40 years. Now, he would need a God that was adequate, wouldn't you say, to do that? Peter needed a God who was adequate to keep him walking over everything everybody else was sinking under. And so do you, and so do I. We've got to reckon on his person, on who he is. And how do we do that? We have to learn about him. That's why we have all these classes, so that we can dig deeper and know the scriptures for ourselves. Because it's what you know of God in times of crisis, as you are sinking under the waves. It's what you know of God, of his character, of his ability, of his characteristics, that's going to keep you sane and give you the power you need to pull on that oar. Get the job done. Reckoning on his person. The Messiah was acknowledged. They were waking up to who he was. Surely you're the Son of God, they said. Surely he was. Only the Son of God can calm a storm and walk on water, make blind eyes see and deaf ears hear. Dumb lips speak. So they reckoned on his person. That's perhaps what you need to do. Who is this God you believe in? Is he big enough? Is he powerful enough to still the storm in your life? Then they reckoned on his presence. They adored the Master. They came, it says here, and they worshipped him. They worshipped him. Lewis says, and it isn't an exact quote, we talk of his presence loudly, but secretly we think of him as being absent. We talk of his presence loudly, but secretly we think of him as being absent. You know, we've got to practice the presence of God. We've got to reckon on his person, on who he is, and his ability. And for that, we'll need to know our theology, and we'll need to know our doctrine, and we'll need to get it straight, and we'll need to get it right. And for that, we'll need to do a little bit of work, a lot of work. But then we have to reckon on his presence. Practicing the presence of God in our personal lives and in our corporate lives. That's what we'll need to do. You know, there's a verse in Revelation chapter 3, verse 20 that says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man or woman hears my voice, opens the door, I will come in." Do you know what that whole picture is about? It's about church. Not an individual and Jesus knocking on the door. In context, it's about a church, the church of Laodicea, in a specific place. And what had happened? They were like this little boat, trying to do it all on themselves without Jesus. And Jesus was actually outside the church, knocking on his own church door, trying to get in, because they were not reckoning with his person, and they were not thinking about his presence. He was not consciously in the boat with him. They were not worshiping him. And it's worship, you see. It's worship that brings the realization of his presence in my personal life and in the life of the church. So we've got to reckon with the person of Christ. We've got to realize his presence. And that happens in prayer day by day. Don't miss a day, folks. Don't miss a day when you come to Jesus and you say, "I'm going to believe every moment of today that you are with me." And then the mission was accomplished. The Messiah was acknowledged. The Master was adored. The mission was accomplished because his power was appropriated. Do you know what it says here? Immediately, says this in John's Gospel, in the same passage of Scripture, immediately the boat was at the land whither it was going. Immediately, Jesus got in the boat, the thing was done. And what happened? They got out of the boat and they began to see to the needs of the people. The lepers and the sick and the problem-orientated people and the little boys that felt they'd been trashed. Jesus and the disciples spilled out of that church into a needy, hurting world. And the work was done. So really, basically, there's the layout of this series. Do you see yourself in the boat? Actually, I believe that every one of the characteristics I've told you that prevented that boat getting where it was on its own strength, Peter embodies. I believe Peter was inadequate. I believe Peter was competitive. I believe that Peter had his doubts. I believe that Peter failed, didn't have what it'd take to do the job that God gave him to do. I believe he embodies all of those, and that's why I've chosen him specifically. And you know, the other reason I've chosen Peter, as we go on and think about him, is because he's so human. He's so human. I love his enthusiasm. He got out of the boat, and you know, I want Jesus to make me like Peter. I'm willing to get out of the boat and be criticized. If that's what it's going to take, and I also want to be like Peter and be a take charge person in my own little realm, and to do what I have to do, and not to be a leave it to Peter person and all the rest of it. Peter has taught me so much. He's challenged me. One of the things I love most about Peter is a little sidelight that I found as I studied for this today. You know, this is talked about in the Gospel of John and also in the Gospel of Matthew and also in the Gospel of Mark. And we know that Mark is supposed to be Peter's gospel. In other words, Peter told Mark the gospel story and all he could about Jesus, and Mark wrote it down. Do you know something really interesting? The Gospel of Mark leaves a little bit of it out. Do you know which bit? About him sinking. Isn't that super? That's why I love Peter. When you're telling all these wonderful stories about what Jesus Christ has done for you, you leave out the bit about your lack of faith and how you sank beneath the waves and how Jesus had to rescue you. A little sidelight onto the man called Peter who turned his world eventually upside down. Let's pray together. Oh God, I ask you quite simply to take your message home to our heart. Thank you for the man called Peter, and thank you for the boat, this marvelous picture of the Church of Jesus Christ. I pray that as we sit in this boat, pulling desperately on our oar, trying to keep alive and well in the storm that is against us, the winds that are contrary to all that we would do for thee. I pray that you would come into our boat as you did in this story, that we may worship you, that we may adore you, that we may reckon with you on stilling the storm for us and taking us and our boat to the shore. And I pray that as we go out from this meeting, we may spill out of our boat to address the needs of a hurting world. I ask it for your glory, for your name's sake. Amen.